Well, welcome once again to our featured photographer of the month, and we're very fortunate to have Jacint Juhász with us today. He is from Hungary. He's an IT architect, travels basically around the world, and if you ever look at his photographs, you'll see that he's in lots of places, and we can all be very jealous of that when it comes to photography. And also with us is Ashley Hunsberger, our editor. Ashley, how are you today?
Doing good. Glad to be here with you both.
Yeah, glad to have you. And Jacint, welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, the pleasure is all ours. Yeah, we connected, you and I connected on our Facebook page a while back.
And exactly.
Yeah, and I like meeting people on there and also our Flickr group. And so I get to check out people's work. And then when it looks really interesting, I like to invite him to come on and talk to us. So anyway, Jacint, like I said, he's an IT architect. He lives in Hungary, travels around the world, actually works for an American company. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your background, how you became such a prolific photographer?
Thank you so much. So yes, that's correct. So I'm an IT architect. I'm actually in IT for 20 years now, and I work in data management space. So that's what I do, and that's also why I travel. So as you said, I work for an American company, and in Eastern Europe where I'm based. So I'm based in Budapest, Hungary. We don't really have a lot of people, so. So that means I'm responsible for 14 countries in Southeast Europe. So I pretty much spend all my time traveling around these countries and obviously for conferences and different meetings, I get to other spaces too. So interestingly enough, this is not how I got into photography, but it made the traveling part much more interesting.
That is interesting. I thought that naturally probably the travels were what drew you to street photography.
So I see a lot of people who start to do photography because they travel, and I remember 6 or 7 years ago when I started to travel massively. I did a shot here and there with my iPhone, and that was pretty much it. But actually, the reason I started was because of the family background. So I have 3 kids, and we had a family camera like every family have. It was. It was an old Fuji bridge camera, which we use, to record family events. And 3 years ago, it just died on us on Christmas. So that year, we couldn't really make the classic Christmas photograph with that camera. So we had to use my iPhone. And at that point, I realized that I took somewhere between 10 to 20,000 pictures with that camera without looking at the settings at all. So we used that camera for I think we bought around the beginning of the 2000s, and it was 3 years ago. So I decided that, so not Christmas Eve, because obviously everything is closed, but as soon as I get into the shops, I buy something more serious and I will read the documents. So this is how it all started.
Wow. And so you got the camera. Yeah. Did you go out on the streets with the camera right after that? Or how did you end up taking street shots?
So basically the way it started is obviously like everybody else, I tried to figure out what to buy. So I went to YouTube and I started to, looking at different reviews and comparisons between different brands and different models and so on. And back in that time, one of the YouTube channels, the guy who was doing the reviews, he was like, taking the camera out to the streets in Hong Kong, and he was doing some sort of street photography with every single camera. And at that point, I realized that basically I'm travel a lot, so this is something I could do. So this is how I got into street photography. Even before that time, I didn't really have a bag which would be big enough to have even a compact camera, because I was optimized for size for traveling. So my bag size was exactly the size of my laptop, and that's it. So I decided to replace my bag so it can hold my camera, and that's how it started, roughly 2.5 years ago.
Instead of buying toys for your toys, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah, I see you shoot lots of film. Is that something you've just started to do recently, or have you always shot film?
No. So that's kind of the downhill, you know. So interestingly, interestingly, the way it happened is that already at the beginning, I start to be very, very interested in black and white, and so I started to focus how to make interesting black and white pictures, what to focus on, you know, much more on light and contrast and shadows instead of different colors. And what I realized over the time that even though I like black and white a lot, so obviously the more people I followed, was most of them was black and white photographers for the most part. And what I realized that when I was going through, you know, my feed and looking at photographs, I always stopped on the ones which was made on film. So figure out how I can emulate the film look with my pictures. So I worked a lot in Lightroom, you know, with different presets you can download from different sites, and then I tried the VSCO one. So I tried to emulate the film look of my pictures. And then I realized that, okay, if I spend so much time to make a film look, then I could try film photography, you know.
And then you don't have to bother with the emulation.
Exactly.
That was such an interesting evolution of events, just from family photos to getting a camera to having the light bulb come on to be like, hey, I travel everywhere. And then from there to black and white, and then back to film. It was just an interesting circle of events.
Yes. And it's, you know, I enjoy every single bit of it. I enjoyed the digital part. I enjoyed Lightroom. I enjoyed, and now I enjoy film. So basically, I picked up my first film camera this year, spring time frame. So that was about 2 years of the whole picking up the camera at all. And that was the point. So when I saw my first pictures on film, I realized that I have no idea about light and shadows and all of this at all. This film reacts completely different way than, you know, digital sensors do. So interestingly, on the first few rows, I had a couple of pictures which gave me the look I was looking for. So they were gorgeous, one or two frames per roll of film. But overall, the whole roll of film was just horrible.
Were you discouraged in that moment?
No, basically that one or two frame per roll encouraged me to figure out, you know, how to see, to see the moment, or to see the lightning, or to figure out what to shoot and how it's going to look like. And basically that brought me on that basically in the beginning of July I made the decision to do 1 year film only.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
Well, there goes my next question. I was going to ask how shooting film has affected your photography when you're using a digital camera, but you're not doing that right now.
So basically what happened, first, like everybody else, I picked up a cheap film camera. It was, it was not the cheapest cheap. Let's say it was around $60. Pretty good quality camera back in the days when it was manufactured, but still not very great one. This was the one I mentioned. I created a few nice photographs, but technically it was extremely limited because the maximum shutter speed it could do was 250th of a second. So you cannot really serious photography with a camera which is like maximum 250th of a second. So when I saw the pictures which I liked, I said that okay, I'm going to get a more a more serious camera. I will see what it can do. And a good thing about film gear is that it's more like a try and buy than digital. So if you look at film gear, if you buy something, if you don't like it, a few months later or even a few years later, you can likely sell for the exact same price. So I said that, okay, let's pick up something more serious. And if I don't like it, I can still sell it,
Yeah, that's a good point.
So basically what I did, I started to look at rangefinder bodies because in digital, I already had the Fuji X100S. And I liked the viewfinder, the optical viewfinder. I liked the way of holding the camera. So I was going for a rangefinder, and basically there's a lot of steps between the $60 compact rangefinder I had and the Leica bodies.
Slightly.
And a couple. And I basically saw myself purchasing through all of these, and actually my wife, typically in these cases, she's much more clear and she's thinking much straightforward, and she told me that you are going to buy all of these in 1 year and you are going to sell all of these in 1 year. So why not, jumping and don't, waste time and money and just buy what you would like. And if you don't like it, you can still sell it. So yeah, she's extremely smart in these cases.
She's a keeper.
I guess she had already seen the progression from the family camera to the digital camera to she saw what was coming.
Oh, yeah. and not only that, but she has a sense of finding stuff on the internet.
Oh.
So I spent awful lot of time going through eBay. Mm-hmm. And local sell and buy forums and things like that, and I didn't find anything nice, not even anything nice and cheap, and the day we agreed that okay, I'm going for the Leica body, she came home, and she had a fantastic deal on her phone, I think on eBay, and the seller was like in the next country, so it was in Austria, Graz. It was a professional Leica seller. The price was just fantastic, and it was an M6 body. So I was looking at it 5 minutes. I pulled the trigger. I ordered it. But the interesting thing was that the next day we went for vacation for 10 days. So I had no idea that, okay, if they delivered, it will stay in a post office or what's going to happen with the camera. So that was basically the story.
It's a tricky subject. A lot of people say it's not about the gear. If you can, if you're a good photographer, you can use anything and make great images. Would you disagree with that?
So I think gear matters in some way. And I think so there are a lot of people say that gear doesn't matter at all, but what I think that if the gear doesn't enable you to make photographs, then you can have the best gear or you can have the worst gear. It doesn't matter. You will not go out taking pictures. So obviously, I think for me personally, it's an emotional relationship. I'm looking for something which, you know, enables me, and doesn't distract.
Yeah, and you have to be able to shoot faster than 1/250th of a second too. So.
that's a valid point right there.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. Obviously, in film photography, the technology is completely different. So in digital, it's important to have a good body, a good camera body. In film photography, it doesn't really matter. Obviously, it has to be accurate in terms of, you know, shutter speed, because all of these are completely mechanical. But when it comes to picture quality, it much more relies on what film you buy, what lens you have, how you develop, what do you develop with, and how you scan or how you print or, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like that that viewpoint. I feel like it's very balanced.
Yeah.
Sometimes people tend to either go to one extreme or the other. It's all about the gear. It's nothing about the gear. But I think what I like about your point of view is that you identified your objective and chose your gear according to that. I think that's probably a good route to take.
Yeah. You know, technically there are a lot of range finders of this technical category, not price category, which would be able to create the same pictures. And obviously it comes down to quality and how it holds and how it feels. So even though I bought it, it was not cheap, obviously. But if I couldn't use it, you know, I would sell it without thinking at all.
Yeah, and that is a big pro of the... like you said, of those cameras, you can resell them pretty easily.
Exactly. There's an extremely good market for, and especially now, film photography is getting more and more popular. So it has its renaissance now.
Well, yeah, and especially a Leica. I mean, that's always going to hold its value. Yeah, which lens are you using with it?
35. It's all 35 for me, and I strongly believe I kept this in my Instagram bio for a long time. This one camera, one lens, mm-hmm. 1 year
mm-hmm.
Thing, because it worked me in the beginning. So when I started out, I did the 50. Millimeter point of view, and it worked out really well for me. So after a couple of months, I knew exactly in my hand that how the frame is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
What's inside, what's out. If I pull the camera up to my face, but after 1 year, I started to feel that the 50 is a little too tight,
mm-hmm.
especially in cities where the streets are more narrow and you cannot include a lot of things or you cannot really step back more because there's a wall behind you. So I decided to try something else, and so I tried 35. I had an upcoming trip to San Francisco and Sunnyvale, where our headquarters is. So I booked any time when I go there, I try to book at least a 3-4 day extra. You know, just going out, taking pictures, having fun, and things like that. Just enjoy life. And that was the first trip with 35, And San Francisco is also, in some of the cases, has these, you know, narrow streets, and it's not really wide.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a very, very good experience with the 35, and this is actually how the Fuji thing came in, because I was looking for a 35 mirror, and that time a lot of street shooter was using the Fuji, the X100 series. So instead of a 35 mil lens, I picked up the X100S, and that was about a year and a half ago maybe, and ever since that I'm on this 35 millimeter point of view. Yeah. And it works out really well for me. Sorry.
Yeah, me too. I've been shooting with the X100 series almost since it came out, and I probably 80% of the time that's what I use. And then when I use my other camera with an 18, I see my photos are too far away, because I don't, you know, you need to get a few steps closer with a wider lens like that, and I just don't do it, at least not consciously.
So I tried that too, and I like it, and actually, if you think of it, it's easier to get close to people if you have a wider lens.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can easily include more in the frame. You don't have to step up, for example, for someone, or go up into their face, because you can kind of showing like you are shooting away from them,
yeah,
but they are still in the frame.
Yeah.
The reason I didn't end up with an 18, which translates to a 28 millimeter lens, right? Because so I have this mix. So I don't only do street or travel, but I also spend a lot of time photographing and, you know, documenting my family. And the 35 is just good for both.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases when on street it would be better to have just a little bit wider, so the view of the 28. But for the family, I don't really like that, because it adds more distortion. So it doesn't look good, for example, for portraits or, you know, shooting people from the close to get the details, for example. And I need to keep this in mind, that I'd like to, you know, create nice memories of my family, and distortion is not, for me, it's not part of being nice, you know.
So you don't want to remember them in future years all with big noses, huh?
Yes. Yes. So that's how I ended up with a 35, and it's just perfect for everything. And obviously, if you are switching back and forth, then the learning is not there. So your brain cannot remember that what's in the frame.
Did you feel like your choice of camera helped you to see lighting as well? I know you said at first when you first took your first roll of film, you realized that you weren't able to see lighting very well or frame things well. So what helped you with that? How did you develop a good eye for light and shadows?
So I thought I have a good understanding with digital, but the way digital sensors renders light and shadows, it makes it much easier. So I remember I had a big luck. That was little over a year ago. I had a trip to Berlin, and it was sunny all day. I had one day for shooting, and it was sunny all day. And I remember looking back at the pictures. That was roughly the first time when I saw on the pictures that I you know, calculated where the light is coming from, how it hits the subject, where are deep shadows and things like that. But so I started to do that when the weather was sunny, and I practiced it a lot. However, when I first tried it on film, it just didn't look good at all. So I looked, in my first role with the Leica was not yet developed by me, so I got it into a lab. And then with the second, I started to develop it myself. And I looked at the pictures, and they just didn't look good. And I mean, some of them did, but it was either way too overexposed, or just turned out gray the whole thing, or it just didn't look good and didn't feel good.
Mm-hmm. So what was the turning point? How did you get from that point to, because now if you look at your Instagram feed, a lot of your images are really characterized by the way you capture the light and the shadows.
Yes.
Was it just a matter of practice, or practice?
Yes, it's a lot of practice. So I'm now 40 something roles, and I'm extremely bad taking notes, so I'm really really bad. And if you shoot with a film camera, which obviously doesn't record any of the details, it's important. So sometimes I do trials. So for example, sometimes I try flash, or sometimes I try things like. A little more overexposed or underexposed, it's how it's going to look like. In most of the cases, I remember those tests, and most of the cases, I remember which frame it was. Or sometimes I make tests to use different filters, and that's also coming from the digital life. Basically try and error, and starting to use of different filters helped me to somehow get that look which I'm looking for.
Yeah, I think with film you just have to pay a lot closer attention.
Yes.
With digital you just fire away, and if it doesn't look right, try it again, but you don't have that luxury with film.
Yes, and for example, if you take that Fuji camera, if you set it up, for example, RAW plus JPEG, mm-hmm. then you can mess in the camera a lot. Mm-hmm. So you can try the different looks of the. There are a lot of these film simulation, and I know the current one have a lot more. So they included Acros and a lot of the fine stuff, but even in the old ones, if you look at the black and white film emulation, you can get the look and feel of the different filters. So that helped me understand that, for example, what a yellow filter is doing,
mm-hmm.
and what a red filter is doing. But it only works if your source of data is color, because all of these filters are going to filter the colors. So even you can apply this in Lightroom. So for example, you take a raw image, you go into Lightroom, and it understands that you have a Fuji raw file, and you can use the built-in camera profiles even in Lightroom, and you can check that how they look like. So I can make I can understand that what's the difference between a yellow filter or red filter.
Mm-hmm.
But if you shoot a black and white image, then there are no colors to filter. So if you scan the black and white film image, and if you apply filters in Lightroom, they don't work.
Oh, that's interesting. I thought they would. Do you do much post-processing of your film images?
Not really. So there's no real on my side, at least. So my workflow is I develop my own film. typically same day. So if I finish a roll of film and I'm not on a trip, then in that exact night I'm going to develop it. Typically the next day I scan it, and most of the decisions are made in the scanning time, because that's when you can get back the look of the film, what you purchased. To be honest, the biggest decision when you make is when you purchase the exact film. So obviously there are countless type of black and white films out there, and it's not only different based on the ISO rating, but also how they look and how the pictures are going to look like. So that's the decision what you make, and basically every photographer has a preference on film, the people who shoot film. So obviously when I scan my images, I want to achieve that look. Currently, I switched the scanning software a couple of days ago, and the one I'm using now, it's called Silverfast. It has built-in presets for different film stocks, so I don't need to mess manually with the different buttons and bars. I just set it to the film which I shot with. I basically set up if I under or overexposed, I set up the brightness of the photo. I scan it and it's done. The only post process I would do if I did a bad job and I scratched the negative, or mm-hmm. if there's some dust on it, then in Lightroom with the cloning tool I would take it out. What? And that's it.
Which scanner are you using?
So originally I purchased an Epson, an entry-level Epson flatbed scanner. I did the basic math, because if you start out with film, the most expensive part is getting it scanned. So obviously it depends the location. I heard the horror stories in the US about development costs, but development altogether is not very expensive. I typically can get film developed for about $4 in Hungary.
That's good price.
Yeah. But for scanning, if you want to get a good quality scan, it's going to be at least $7-$8 per roll, and it's not really an issue on the price, but the real issue is that if someone else is scanning your images, then someone else is doing decisions for your images. So basically, you are giving away the post-processing part.
Yeah, I've never really been happy with the film I had scanned. Not. Yeah,
absolutely not. So after my first roll, I had scanned. Basically, I said that okay. I like it. I kind of like it, but I need to figure out the scanning part. So I did the basic math. I checked that what is the cheapest photo scanner, which is good enough cost, and I said that okay, it's going to be the same cost as 19 rolls of film get scanned. So I said that okay, I'm purchasing this scanner, and we will get back and see 20 rolls later. So that was 40 rolls before, and I was looking at okay, what other options out there, because obviously it had limitations, but it helped me learn the process. So basically, yesterday I purchased a dedicated film scanner. It's a plastic. It's a small box. It has a film adapter. You put your film strip in it, and basically it's going to scan. It's not a flatbed. It's a dedicated film scanner. It has obviously technically better parameters, and it was I picked it up used, so it was roughly two times the price of the previous one. So I did a very good deal. And currently I'm relearning scanning because everything is different now.
So the software, does it work with any scanner or does it only work with specific models?
The previous Epson does its own software. So when you purchase an Epson scanner, you get the Epson software with it, which is fairly good. Even big names are using that software, so it does what it needs to do. Some other brands like Plastec, they work together with software manufacturers, and this Plastec have three versions for the same hardware. You can purchase it without software. You can purchase it with Serverfast. It has two different versions. One of them is called SE. The other one is called AI. The AI has some extra automation into it. I picked up the SE one. So these softwares, which are not dedicated to one scanner brand, they work with nearly all scanners. So as long as the operating system detects the scanner, the hardware, you can use it with this advanced scanner software.
You have me thinking here. That's dangerous.
It is, yes.
Yes.
I'm telling you, it is.
I need your wife to help me buy something. Well, it's a long way to ship. Hey, let's talk about some of your photos. You have a lot.
All right.
Yeah, you have a lot of photos in your Instagram feed, and so obviously we can't talk about all of them. But I've got a well. There's one. It's a picture of somebody walking in front of a building, with a statue on the left and the shadow of the statue.
Oh, I got you.
I really like this. You took it with HP5. I don't know how to pronounce the name of the city. Skopje.
It's called Skopje.
Skopje. Okay, thank you.
Yes, Skopje. Skopje used to be. So Skopje is in a country, which is called by the people who live there, called Macedonia. But so they don't agree with the people of Greece on the naming, because Macedonia is a historical place. If you remember Alexander the Great, and they both claim, so Macedonia and Greece, they both claim Macedonia being part of their country. So currently they don't really agree on the name of the country, but officially the name of the country is the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia. So I spent there quite some time, and they built this interesting architecture there, and I was there 2 weeks ago, and I had 2 days. One of them was raining from midnight to midnight, and the second day was shining, and I had a packed agenda. I had already my meeting at 9, so the only chance I got to go out to take pictures between the breakfast, which is 6:30 for me, and between leaving the hotel, which was 8:30. So I decided to go out for an hour, and that's when I took this picture. I had a fantastic light, and I was extremely lucky with this light.
Yeah, there's so many beautiful aspects to this image. The lighting also just, like you said, the architecture is interesting. I feel like there's a variety of textures, and the layers in this photo are really nice.
Yeah, one thing, I've looked through a lot of your photos, and I find them to be very, they're not busy. They're simple. Mm-hmm. If there's a person in it, there's only one or maybe two. So they're very, so many street photos have lots of people in them and a lot of things going on. And I think, you're really good at just isolating one person or one thing. And I wish I could do that better. I don't know if that's by design or that's just, you know, that's just how you're wired.
So it depends. It depends on two things mainly. One of them is the city I shoot in, and the other is the mood I have. So for example, in most of the European cities, you can do this very easily because you don't really get the crowd. What you have in New York. In New York, it was hard to do this. I managed to get some of the photos, like with the single subject, focusing on that specific single subject. But it's much easier to do it in Europe. I tried a lot of things and probably I didn't try everything, but a lot. And when I'm looking back on my own photos, I just much more, you know, close to those which have a single or maybe two subjects, if there's something interesting about them. It doesn't mean that this is the only thing I like. Obviously, I follow a lot of people who, you know, create busy photos with layers and an action between them, and I absolutely like them. As well, I follow a lot of people who master color, you know, complementary colors and things like that. But it's simply not what interests me. I think I can. I'm much more interested to, especially if I get closer, I'm much more interested to get somehow the feeling of the subject, what they may feel or what their mood is, if I get a single one and I can focus on that single one.
Yeah, another good example of that is one you took in Romania. You can help me with the name of the city, Timișoara.
Timișoara.
Actually, there's two I really like from there. One is a photo of a person walking towards a church in a square, and you captured the sunlight just over the top of the building.
Mm-hmm. It's the interesting part is that I travel a lot and I never spend a lot of time in a single city. So my typical trips are 2 or 3 days, maximum 3 days. So that means that I can go out taking pictures one, maybe two times, in extremely lucky cases, three times. And I don't have a lot of time. So it's not like I'm going out for a half day shooting. I'm going out for a good hour. Maybe I'm going out for dinner and I have an hour before or hour and a half, but not a lot. And obviously all of these cities are extremely different from each other. They have a lot of things. There's a lot of similarities, but most of them are different. People are different. The way they react to the camera is different. And I'm trying to find those moments when I can include something from the city itself. So some of the cityscapes, something which is very, very, which brings me back to that specific space. So I can say, yeah, I remember where is that. I remember when I took the photo because at the end of the day what I'm doing is it's kind of, you know, it's kind of a diary, a visual diary of my trips. So obviously because of the process and I'm sitting some of the pictures, you typically see the pictures on my Instagram feed 2 weeks after I've been in that specific city. So I've been 2 weeks ago in Skopje, so I'm posting the pictures from the Skopje trip. Last week I was in Berlin, so probably next week I will start to post my Berlin pictures. but it's kind of a diary which follows the trips I did and follows somehow the mood, you know, because I get for example I get to typically cities in every 2 months or every 3 months, but it's not the same. I'm not going to the same places to take pictures, or even if I do, there typically the light is different, the weather is different, maybe the season is different, and for sure the people are different.
Yeah, you can only get so far and with 1 or 2 hours on your hands.
Not really, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Well,
I think you do really well at capturing the essence of cities, though. One thing I noticed about your images, like Bob said, usually you only have maybe one or two persons in the image. And sometimes you're not even very close to them. But even in those images, there's still a feeling or a mood to the image. And I was thinking maybe that's the mood of the city that you're capturing.
Maybe. So sometimes the city, because some of the cities are, you know, more sad, and some of the cities are more more funny or more, you know. And sometimes because in most of the days, either I'm shooting in the early morning, and if you look at the people in the early morning when they are busy getting to work, they look different. And sometimes I'm shooting in the afternoon. And if I'm shooting in the afternoon, I'm typically after, you know, 6 or 8 hours of working, working with people. I either do workshops, or I try to help them figure out what to do, or just listening to their stories. And it's also different if I'm going out shooting after having a day working like this. Obviously, my mood is completely different when I'm going out in the morning. I'm fresh. I just had a fantastic breakfast, and I have a quick hour to take a few pictures.
Yeah. What's your favorite time to shoot? Do you prefer shooting in the morning?
No. So I don't have any, and I can't plan any. And
just because they're so different?
Exactly. And with film, it's a little more difficult, and that's how I ended up shooting everything 1600 ISO, because that's something I can plan. So if it's bright, sunny, it still works. If it's in the middle of the night, it still works, because I never know in advance when I'm going to have time, or what the lighting conditions are going to look like. And I can't plan any of that. So if I have an hour of shooting, I'm extremely thankful. You know, but what I like the most is late fall and winter time when it's sunny, because the sun is low. So basically in winter, if you get a sunny day, you can get very, very similar light what you would get in summer, only for an hour or hour and a half.
Yeah, exactly.
In winter, you get it all day.
The hard part is finding a sunny day. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and I don't mind cold. I can you know, I can wear many clothes against cold. So I don't mind.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we've got time for one more photo, and actually, if you don't mind, matter of fact, I sent you a link to this, Ashley, so if you wanted to see it.
Yeah, I saw it.
Yeah, sorry, didn't do that sooner. This is one of my favorites.
I've been finding them.
Oh, okay. There's just so many. This is one of my favorites. You posted it back in February. It was taken in Athens of a sailor walking in front of a building.
I remember that
graffiti.
One, yes.
Yeah, I love it. I love the fact he's looking right at you, and the light on his face, and the old lady in the background.
It's very timeless.
Yes, it is.
Maybe I guess the graffiti could date it, but
oh, that's true.
But it still has that feel, that classic feel.
So one thing about that photo is that was when I tried out the 18mm lens.
Aha.
Yeah, so that's actually the field of view of 28, so I was extremely close to this guy. Basically that pedestrian path is not wider than 2, maybe 2.5 meters. So I was very, very close to him. And that's my favorite part of Athens. It's in the city center. It's between two famous squares. One is called Omonia, the other is Monastriaki. It's between the two. And on my previous Athens trip, which was a couple of weeks ago, I managed to find a hotel which is exactly in the middle of in this area. And you find something interesting every single time when you are there. It's the middle of, you know, all the markets are there. There's a lot of transport, both international and local. And now Greece and Athens is also affected massively by the people movement,
the refugees,
refugee crisis, and that's also where you see a lot of different cultures. So it is a very, very interesting place, both culturally, looking at people, looking at daily flow. Anytime I have like half an hour, I go out and I can spend some time there. It's fantastic.
Oh boy, it's nice being close to so many interesting places.
Oh yes, and Athens is basically one of my top. I typically say I have two places which are equally my favorites between those which I frequently visit. So Athens is one of them, and Sarajevo is the other one. So if I get a request to go for work in any of these, I couldn't really make a decision which one to go to. I like them equally, and these two are the best.
We'll have to add them to our travel lists.
Oh yeah, I already wrote it down.
Definitely. Definitely.
So before we go, can you tell us quickly, what do you get out of this? What keeps you coming back? Why do you keep doing it?
Oh, a lot of things, actually. One of them is, for me, this grainy black and white look is beautiful. I like the beauty of it, and basically I want to see things how they look like on this surface, you know. And the fantastic part of film is, you know, you don't see it at the moment when you take the picture. There's no flashing of the picture in your viewfinder that, hey, this is what you just take. So I take the picture, and in a couple of days when I develop, I look at the negative. I don't have loop, so I only see that, okay, is it somewhat properly exposed and somewhat in focus. So in a few days later when I scan it, I see the picture back in that specific format what I like. So I you mentioned this Ilford HP5. That's my go-to film. I use it at 1600 ISO. It makes it grainy, so I get this grainy contrast image. I have a yellow filter almost all the time on the lens. If I take it off, I only take it off to put on the red one, which is even more contrasty. So that's where the contrast is coming from. So one thing is the pushing of the film. It makes it grainy and contrasty. And the other thing is the filter. And I'm interested how things look like on this film. And the other thing, obviously, is creating these memories, family memories. So I learned. In the beginning, I was so much focusing that if I take pictures of children, it have to be colorful, it have to be, you know, funny, it have to be, you know, like a kind of a lifestyle or something like that. And over the time I learned that you can make a beautiful photo of your children, even if it's grainy black and white, if the mood, if the expression is right, if the lighting is right, it doesn't really matter if it's color or black and white. And at the end of the day, it's my picture. It's the way I want to remember. And for me, it's beautiful. It may not be beautiful for others. And sometimes I get comments, but for me, it's beautiful.
Wow, that's perfect way to end it. So,
yeah.
So where can people find your work?
It's Instagram. That's it. So it's I use my first name on Instagram, Jacint. I replace the one with an I with a one, because the name was already used. Instagram is my go-to place. I went there because I heard that Instagram has a fantastic street photography community, which is true. Mm-hmm. It's extremely direct. You can talk to people. Some people will talk to you, some won't. But there are plenty of space to have fantastic conversations. But I got to tell you that the film community on Instagram is even better than the street photography community. So I learned so much from people there that it's the best place to be. I don't really have anything. I don't have a website. I don't have a Facebook page. I do something on Flickr, but maybe I post a picture a week or something like that. But Instagram is the place for me.
Keep it simple. Always a good idea. Well, that's wonderful. Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you taking the time and appreciate your comments on our Facebook page. So it's really nice to be able to connect with you in person. Well,
yeah,
sort of
you've shared some really nice insights for everyone today, too.
Wonderful.
Just on film and photography in general. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a fantastic experience. And thank you. And obviously, thank you for what you do for the street photography community. You know, I read the articles and I'm active on the Facebook page somewhat. So even though I don't have my own Facebook page, I'm active in Facebook groups where discussions are, you know. And for people, you know, who want to learn, these are the resources to go to. So thanks for doing this.